Okay, the next step on the camera model is taking into account the distortion in the lens. Well, usually this distortion, the main type of distortion that appears in real lenses is called either barrel distortion, that is when a rectangle appears as a barrel, or pincushion distortion, distortion de almohadilla or de barril in Spanish. Okay? And these both kinds of distortion are essentially the same. It's a radial distortion that can be computed in that way with a single coefficient, the radial distortion coefficient K1. Then the relationship between the theoretical and distorted coordinates and the real distorted coordinates is this one, multiplying by 1 plus k multiplied by r squared, where r corresponds to the radio of the point to the center of the image. Okay? Then, with the distorted, in this expression, if we know the distorted coordinates, simply multiplying by this factor, we can obtain the theoretical and distorted coordinates. This is very useful, for example, for correcting digital photographs. If you have a cheap digital camera, typically when you take wide-angle shots, they typically have barrel distortion. And if you have a zoom lens, it's quite typical that at the long side of the lens, long side of the zoom, you get pincushion distortion. Then you have two options: either buy a much expensive camera, or go to Photoshop or to other software and correct the distortion by software. Then the correction is simply doing this computation, taking the coordinates of each pixel and convert to new and distorted coordinates. Okay. Then, and finally, these coordinates x and y are still in millimeters. Then if we want to compute the pixel coordinates in row and column, we have to transform using a linear transformation in this way. The u coordinate will be proportional to the coordinates in millimeters, where this dx dimension conversion corresponds to the pixel size on the sensor, the size of the pixel inside the camera. Then if you divide by this dimension, you get a dimensional number in number of rows. In all analogic cameras, you need here also a coefficient that typically is close to 1, but maybe not 1, to correct for the sampling speed of your computer along each line on the camera. Okay? In digital cameras, this doesn't happen anymore, then S is 1, because 1 pixel in the camera corresponds to 1 pixel in your image in your computer. And then you have to add the coordinates in pixels of the center of the image. Okay? Then with this transformation, you obtain U or V, that are the coordinates in rows and columns of our pixel inside the image. Well, sometimes for analogic cameras, you have to take into account other factors. For example, sometimes analogic cameras allow you to take all the lines or only half the lines in your image. Taking a lower resolution camera, then the effective size of the pixel in vertical, in this case, is double the real size inside the camera. Okay? And then also, if you in an analogic camera, you have an analogic signal that the computer has to sample, then if the number of pixels inside the camera and the number of pixels in memory for each row is different, you have to use the appropriate conversion factor to compute the actual size of the pixel. Then, for example, for this old analogic camera that has inside this number of pixels in horizontal and vertical, and the size of each pixel is this, if this kind of image is sampled, obtaining in your computer an image of 512 rows and columns, then the effective size of the pixel in your image is more or less this, 12 and something microns and 8 and something microns in horizontal and vertical. This means that in this case, the pixel aspect ratio is 1.5. It means that one pixel has not the same size, do not correspond to the same size in horizontal and in vertical, but in this case with a relationship of 1.5. The same camera, if the computer samples 768 pixels in horizontal, then with the same camera you have a square pixel camera. The size in horizontal and vertical is the same, 8.2 microns. Okay? Well, then finally, a summary. The projection function has four steps. First, convert the absolute coordinates to coordinates with respect to the camera. Second, compute the projection of the point in the camera, the theoretical projection. Third, compute the actual projection distorted. And finally, compute the projection in pixels, in rows and columns. Okay? Then the whole set of parameters that appear in these equations, in this projection model, are a couple of known parameters, that is the size of the pixel inside the camera. Okay? And the parameters that need to be calibrated are the extrinsic parameters, that are the orientation of the camera and the position of the camera, and the intrinsic parameters, that are focal length of the objective, of the lens. Usually the focal length is theoretically known. If you look at your lens, there is written the focal length in millimeters. But this is not very precise. If you need to have better precision, you need to calibrate F. K1 is the radial distortion coefficient. Usually lenses do not specify the amount of this coefficient, then you need to calibrate it. The center of the pixel, the center of the image in the pixel, and for analogic cameras, this correction factor for the sampling of the pixels. Then these are the parameters that need to be calibrated in actual cameras. Okay, one way of, in stereo vision, a simple way to take rid of most of these parameters is to normalize the image. You take an image and convert the coordinates of the point in this image to normalized coordinates. This means, essentially, well, the normalized retina is a theoretical retina that is located at a focal length of one unity. Okay? Then on this ideal retina without distortion, the projection of a point could be obtained simply with this expression that is very simple. Coordinate U is X divided by Z, and coordinate V is Y divided by Z. Simply that. Then, in practice, if you have a real retina, you can compute normalized coordinates simply correcting the distortion. First computing the coordinates in millimeters, correcting the distortion, I mean, undistorting the image, and dividing by the focal length. Then, for each point in your current image, you can obtain the normalized coordinates of this point. And if we have done this, coming back to slide number 14, you already know the normalized coordinates of points. The rest of the computations needed for stereo vision can be done as simple as these two expressions. We're simply dividing the x and y coordinate by z. Okay? Then if you undistort and normalize the coordinates, you can forget about all the internal parameters of the camera. Okay, just a word about how can be the calibration performed. Our camera model is this projection model. Then our problem is that we usually don't know the parameters theta in our model. Then to obtain these parameters, the typical way is put a pattern of known points where the coordinates of the points are perfectly known. Obtain the coordinates of these points in our image. Then, in this case, we know u and x. And try with that to compute theta, the parameters. Okay? Then the way to compute this is obtaining the set of parameters that minimizes the squared error. Then for this, usually you need a least squares technique in your computer that, taking as data u and x, is able to compute the parameters. Okay, once you have calibrated your camera, now you are ready to do computer vision, stereo vision. Then, which is the simplest way? The simplest case is with two cameras looking parallel, with the optical axis looking forward in parallel. Then, in this case, the essential parameter defining our stereo system is B, called the baseline. Baseline is the distance between the two optical centers of the cameras. Then, this is a top view of our stereo system. This is left camera, the left camera, with the image plane and his focal length. Okay? And the right camera with his image plane and focal length. Then, if you look at this, at the geometry of the problem, the projection of a point P that is located at a depth Z, this point P projects in coordinate x1 on the left camera and coordinate x2 on the right camera. Then the coordinates of the point can be recovered looking at these triangles. For example, first triangle, this x value here must be x coordinate divided by z coordinate and multiplied by f. Right? I'm simply applying the proportionality between this small triangle and the big one. Okay? Then you obtain first equation. On the second camera, the same. The proportion between this small triangle and this big triangle is in this way. X2 can be obtained like this coordinate divided by z and multiplied by f. Okay? And this coordinate x with respect to camera 2 is the same that the coordinate x with respect to the camera 1 minus b. Okay? And that's it. Then, taking these two equations, we can solve for z. Then z can be obtained as the baseline multiplied by f and divided by this thing that is called disparity. The disparity is the difference in the coordinates of the peaks of the point in one camera and in the other camera. Then, if a point is seen the same in both cameras, it means that x1 minus x2 is zero, then the point is at infinity. Same with your eyes. If you say a point exactly the same with both eyes, it means that it's very far away. If the difference of how you see the point in both eyes is big, it means that the point is very close. Okay. And The other two parameters are proportional to the focal length, because we know that bigger focal length means bigger things, and also to the baseline. Okay? If the baseline increases for the same baseline, it means that things are farther away for the same disparity. Okay? Do you have any question? Is that clear?
What is when the point is on the left side? So don't we have to do the absolute value of each point?
Absolute value?
So if point P is on the left side, then we
can okay. I've drawn here the easy case, that is both coordinates are positive. Okay? But if you change the sign, nothing happens. I mean, if you put x equal to b halves, b over 2, for example, the equations are exactly the same. Nothing changes. It's more difficult to you to figure out the equations in that case, but the equations are exactly right. Exactly correct. If you replace here, if you put the point just in the middle, you will get x1 with one value and x2 same value, opposite sign. Okay? Then the difference will not be zero. The disparity will not be zero. Will be two times the coordinates in the left camera, for example. Okay? And then everything goes the same. You don't need to touch the equation if the sign of one of the parameters changes. Okay, the equation is exactly the same. Then, zero disparity means a point that is at infinity. Positive disparity means a point that is close. If the disparity is very big, the point is close. If you have negative disparity, what happens? If x1 minus x2 is negative, what happens in that case? Can you imagine? Can you put p in some place such that x2 is bigger than x1? Where? No. If you put it on the left side, it's still correct. If you put it on the left side, you have here left camera, right camera, and a point on the left. This is x1, for example, say minus 3 pixels. And this is x2, for example, minus 20 pixels. Okay? The difference, x1 minus x2, is positive. Okay? The only way to have a negative value of disparity is having a point on the back of the cameras. If the point is on the back, I mean, if Z is negative, okay? Then you have negative disparity, but then you can see the points. Okay? The negative disparity means error, because you are trying to compute a point that you have not seen, definitely. Okay? Or it's the same thing, you can think on it in that way. If you see a point in coordinates x2 in the second camera, if you look for this point on the left camera, you have to look to the right, never to the left. Okay? Because the coordinates has to be bigger on the left camera than on the right camera. Okay, then, using this computation, if we know that this point P1 corresponds to point P2, we can compute the depth of the point. Once we have the depth, we can replace the depth in these equations, and we can compute x, that is the coordinate, the lateral coordinate of the point with respect to the camera. Same for y. This is the view from the top, but for y you will have exactly the same expression. Then, this is the proof that seeing the point in two cameras, it is possible to compute the depth of the point and compute the x and y coordinates, for example, with respect to the left camera. Okay? What happens in the more general case? This was the simplest one, with two cameras looking exactly parallel. In practice, we may be interested in putting two different cameras looking with a different angle, and maybe not even with parallel axes. Okay? Well, in that case, the equations are a little more complicated, but the idea is exactly the same. Okay? What we need to know is the position and orientation of each camera. Then K represent in these equations each possible camera. Okay? Then suppose we have two, three cameras, I don't care. We know how to compute coordinates, how to transform coordinates between the absolute reference and the reference of each camera with these equations. Okay? Then we simply put these equations in that way, calling Rik to each vector of this rotation matrix. Okay? Then the projection using normalized coordinates is x divided by z and y divided by z, and after some manipulations we can group the coordinates x of the point in a vector, and then the projection of all the points of one point in all the cameras must fulfill this equation a multiplied by x plus b equal to 0, okay, where I is a set of parameters that come from the rotation of each camera and the projection of each point in each camera. Okay? And B, same thing. Okay? Same corresponds to coordinates of the position of each camera and coordinates of the points inside each camera. Then, the actual coordinates of the point must fulfill this equation, A multiplied by X plus B equal to 0. Then, if we know A and we know B, we simply have to solve for X. Solve for X means obtaining the coordinates of the point in three dimensions. For example, suppose we have n images, we have three unknowns, the coordinates of the point, the absolute coordinates of the point. Then we obtain the equation, the linear equation, by simply putting together the matrices A for all the cameras and matrices B for all the cameras. And then we simply have to solve this equation. Well, if we have two cameras, this equation has actually four equations with three unknowns. Okay, then it's an overdetermined equation. If we have three cameras, it's the same. We will have six equations and only three unknowns. Okay? Then, to solve for this equation, A is not a square matrix. Then to solve for this equation, you don't have to use the inverse, you cannot use the inverse of A, but the pseudo-inverse of A. And that's it. Okay? Then knowing the projection of the point in several cameras, you obtain A and B, you solve the system, and you obtain the three-dimensional coordinates of the point. If you make this for the special case of parallel cameras, then the rotation and translation are represented by these matrices, you obtain exactly the same thing. we obtain first. The analytical solution in this case is Z can be obtained as B divided by the disparity, and the rest X and Y are obtained multiplying the value obtained for Z by the horizontal and vertical coordinates of the point in one of the cameras. Okay? Then, the equation AX plus B equal to 0 is this equation in this case, has four rows, four equations, and only three unknowns. Okay? It means that there is one restriction. There is one more equation than unknowns. Then there must be one restriction. Which is the restriction here? You can manipulate this equation and obtain that the restriction here is that for the parallel camera situation, the point, the projection of the point in one camera and in the other camera must be on the same row. If you imagine the two cameras exactly parallel, the point projects in both cameras exactly in the same row, because the point is at the same height with respect to both cameras. Okay? Then, this, in general, is called the epipolar constraint. The epipolar constraint in this simple case is, if I know the projection of one point in one camera, in the other camera must be in the same row. Okay, in the more general case, the geometry can be seen with this epipolar plane. Suppose I have a camera here, this represents, this diagram represents the image plane in camera 1, and the center of the camera C, and same for camera 2. Okay, and I have a point P. Well, the plane that goes, that passes through P, C1 and C2, is called the epipolar plane of point P. Okay? Then, given three points, there is only one plane that passes through the three points. Okay? Then, its projections, the projection of P in camera 1 is P1, belongs to the epipolar plane. The projection of P in camera 2 is P2, also belongs to the epipolar plane. Okay? That's the geometry clear. Then, what's the epipolar constraint for P1? Suppose I've seen in camera 1, I've seen one point, P1. Where to look for this point in the second camera? Then, I know point P1. I know C1 and know C2. Knowing three points, I can compute the plane. Okay? Then, with C1, C2, and P1, I can compute the epipolar plane. If I know the epipolar plane, and I know the image plane of the second camera, computing the intersection, I get this line. That is the epipolar line of point P1. Then, the correspondent to point P1 in the second image must be on this epipolar plane. In this epipolar line. Okay, then where to look for this point in the second image? Along this epipolar plane. Along the epipolar line. Okay? Of course, the problem, then looking for correspondences, in this case, it's a monodimensional problem. If I see one fly in left camera, and I look for the fly in the second camera, I will have to look along a line in the second camera, along the epipolar line. Okay? If there is only one fly in the room, no problem, I will find it. If there is 1,000 flies, it may happen that three or four flies are exactly on the epipolar line. If all flies look the same, there is no way I can guess which one is the correct one. Okay? Then, if there are several candidates for point P1 along its epipolar line, I cannot solve the association problem, then I cannot compute the depth to the point. If there is only one candidate, I'm happy and I can compute the depth. Okay. Then, similar thing happens with correspondences. If I look for correspondences for lines, typically, if we are interested in the depth to objects, the distance to objects, we may be interested in obtaining edges using the techniques we already study, and try to find these edges on the second image. Then one problem, for example, here is that point P1 is an edge point, in this case in an horizontal line. If I look for this point in the second image, the bipolar line, I'm supposing here that both cameras are parallel, the bipolar line is this one. Then in the second image, there are many points that look exactly as P1. Okay? Then, for an horizontal line, and using two cameras that are placed in horizontal, there is no way to compute the depth to points that are on this edge. However, for vertical planes, for vertical edges, it's very easy, because if you look at the bipolar line of point P2, there is only one candidate that looks the same that P2. That is also an edge point. Okay? Then if you obtain edge points in two images and try to look for correspondences, edges that are parallel to the baseline between the cameras cannot be computed, its depth cannot be properly computed. Okay? Well, this is, it's quite an important result to take into account. For example, if you want to build a robot that has two cameras looking for things, and we put the cameras as we have the cameras, parallel, in horizontal, then if we try to go up or down several steps, the edge of the step will be parallel to the baseline. Okay? Then it is not possible to compute the depth of the steps. Then with a robot, if you try to go up or down several steps with two eyes located in that way, you will fall down. You will not be able to guess the correct depth of the steps. You have several solutions. Either put a third eye here, and then you have baseline in vertical. With this, you can compute the depth to horizontal lines. Or twist your head. If you twist your head, the baseline is not anymore parallel to the stairs, and you can compute the depth to the stairs. Okay? Otherwise, it's dangerous. We are able to compute the depth to steps because the steps usually have some texture and our eyes have enough resolution to match the points in one eye and the points in the other eye. Okay? But if the stairs were perfectly smooth, it's very difficult to compute the depth. Proof. Go to the mountains to the snow in a cloudy day. Okay? Have you ever tried to walk on the snow in a very cloudy day? No one? Too bad. You have to try it. Okay. The problem is, in the snow, everything is white. Okay? Then, when there is sun on the snow, you have many bright points on the snow. Then you see one bright point with one eye, same bright point with the other eye, you can compute the depth to the point. Then you are able to figure out the shape of the snow. Okay? In a very cloudy day, there is no bright points on the snow. Then all snow points look the same. Conclusion. You see one snow point with left eye. You see thousands of snow points with your right eye. You don't know which one is which one. Then you are not able to compute the depth of the snow. Then, if there is a big hole, you don't see it. As simple as that. Then, when you walk in a very cloudy day on the snow, it's very typical to fall down because you are not able to figure out the depth or your next step. With a sunny day, no problem. With a cloudy day, trouble. Okay? Let's go and try. Okay, then how to compute, how to obtain the correspondent to one point? Well, the easy way is matching using correlation. Matching with correlation, it's I take a point in the camera and some neighbors, and I try to find this same pattern on the other image. Okay? Well, this can be done matching two patterns, can be done simply computing the difference in brightness in the two small windows. I put this, take this window, and I pass through the second image, and for every position, I compute this thing, the sum of square difference. Where the difference is zero, I found the point. Okay? Then, second technique is using normalized correlation. That is more or less, it's a similar way, a little more precise. You compute the correlation coefficient between the brightness in the small window in the left image and every possible, small window in the right image. Where the correlation is big, it means that it may be the same point. Okay? Well, there are currently commercial systems that do exactly that, even in hardware. For example, this is a case of a stereo camera. I don't know if you can see it properly. Maybe it's too much light here. Here is a small camera, this big, with two cameras. You can see here one lens in black and the other lens, okay, with two small cameras with a baseline of around 10 centimeters, I think, 10, 12 centimeters. And here on the back you have a small computer. Okay? Then this camera takes two images. First thing is it do is to rectify the images. It means correcting the distortion. You see here the undistorted image where look at the whiteboard that is has barrel distortion, and here the distortion is corrected. The whiteboard is rectangular. Okay? Then first thing, correct distortion. Second, obtain features using a Laplacian of Gaussian that we have already studied. And then compute correlations to obtain the disparities from points in the left image to points in the right image. Then this is a map of the disparities in this case, and this is the same thing filtered. I mean removing points where the match is not very precise. Okay? And this represents disparity in brightness. Brighter, in this case, I think means closer thing, see the smaller disparity. And finally, three-dimensional reconstruction. Knowing the disparity, we can compute the three-dimensional coordinates of the point, and here you see a projection of the three-dimensional view of the environment. This is another example with a guy. This is left image and right image. And this is the three-dimensional model computed of the face of this guy. Okay, This, for working, needs good texture in the images. Same as in the snow. If you try to compute the depth to this table that is plain white, the correlation between left and right image will not work, and you will not be able to compute the depth of these points. Okay? Then, actually, stereo cameras work better outside, in outdoors, than in indoors. Because in indoors, there are many surfaces that are too flat, without texture. And the system is not able to compute correlations. And outdoors, you have grass, you have trees, you have cars that have better texture properties. Okay, and finally, there are other ways to build three-dimensional cameras that are more expensive and cumbersome. For example, same as a stereo vision can be obtained with a camera and an active illumination system, an active lighting system. For example, if I project a plane of light, typically a laser plane, it's quite easy. You simply take a laser pointer, put in the middle of the ray, put a cylindrical lens, and then the beam is split in a plane. As simple as that. I don't have a cylindrical lens with me, but you could try. Okay? Then you get a laser plane. If you know the coordinates of the laser plane, because you are moving it from left to right, and you have a camera, you can compute the depth to the points. How? Using a math very similar to the stereo system. The baseline in this case is the distance between the camera and the lighting system. If you know the angle of the system, you can compute this plane. If you know the projection of a point, you can compute this other plane, this other line. Then the intersection of this line with the lighting plane gives you the coordinates of the point. Easy. Okay? Only thing is that if you want to obtain the three-dimensional map of an environment, you have to move your plane, your light, to illuminate every possible position in the environment. Then you have to scan the environment with the light and take several images, one for every position of the lighting. Okay? But this is a three-dimensional scanner. You will get a three-dimensional map of the environment. And in this case, this doesn't depend that much on the texture of the objects, because what you are looking for is for red points illuminated in the objects, okay? That are very easy to distinguish inside the camera. This, for example, is also a three-dimensional image taken with a three-dimensional laser scanner. That is a system that makes motions with a laser beam, makes a 2D scanning, and for every position of the laser beam, computes the distance to the point using typically phase, the difference in phase between the light that goes and the return, and the reflection. You take both waves, compute the phase, the difference in phase, and the difference corresponds to the distance to the object. And this is an example of a robot we have here in the robotics lab that has this kind of laser scanner. Here is a laser projector that throws a laser beam to here, that is a mirror that rotates. Okay? And then the mirror rotates and is projecting the point all around the robot. And you can get this kind of representations with all the scanning performed by the laser. Then these are other ways of obtaining three-dimensional information. This is the same thing. Using a laser scanner here, mounted on a small helicopter, a roboticized helicopter, and then this scanner is scanning continuously the environment. If the helicopter flies around a building, you can obtain a complete three-dimensional model of the building. This also can be done, for example, with a laser scanner put on top of your car. You put the scanner on top of your car with a plane looking in that way to the sides. You can move the car and you can obtain three-dimensional points on the buildings around the car. Okay? Well, I think that it's already possible to see some of these models in Google Earth. There are some cities that are already being scanned using this kind of three-dimensional scanners, and then you can see the actual three-dimensional shape of the buildings in your computer. Well, and that's all for today, and that's all for the classes of computer vision. Then, thanks for your attention, and please remember that this week and next week we will be correcting your practical labs. Okay, please go to our desk and sign up for reserve your timing, the timing you prefer to defend your work. Thank you.